Afternoon, comrades, friends.
Afternoon.
Thank you for turning up. Keith Scholey has struggled his way from the great unknown north of Watford to talk to us this afternoon on the left and the First World War. I'll hand the meeting over to Keith.
Right. Hello there. What I'll be talking about today is the left and the First World War. It's quite specific. What I'll be dealing with is five different names. There's two publications, which are The Clarion and Freedom, and three groups. The British Socialist Party, the Independent Labour Party, and the Socialist Labour Party. Now, this sounds a bit like one of those alphabet soup sort of things, and it will sound a bit like that, and of course the old joke about the tooting popular front. But they are quite distinct, and, you know, you might get to know a little bit more about them, which is what I hope. I think, first of all, I'd like to say how the left of 1914 differs from that of today. And one way is that all of the groups and publications I'm going to be talking about were fairly recently established. None of them were over 25 years old. And to put that into context, we're talking about going back to 1990. And I think most left groups of today are founded pretty much before then, or they have their roots before then. The second thing I'd like to say, and in relation to that, I've got to say that because they were fairly recently established, there was no great traditions to live up to. For the left today, to be, for example, in favour of a war would be against a lot of the traditions of the left. The left is traditionally anti-war in this country. So it would, there wasn't that pressure to live up to those expectations. The second thing I'd like to say is that the left was not numerous. Probably altogether these groups were no greater than the left of today. But when you consider that the ILP, the Independent Labour Party, was the political content of the Labour Party itself, if you wanted to join the Labour Party, you had to join the ILP, or you were expected to. That was the branch structure of the Labour Party, was the ILP branches. So if you take that into consideration, you'll find that, in fact, it was much, much smaller than it is today. Another point I'd like to make is that there was a high turnover of members. One of the reasons why that was is because it was difficult to have any sort of political opinions, because as soon as you became known, you were slung out of a job. So you tended to have people join for a year and then go. Whereas these days, I think most leftists are fairly well established. They're in there for the long term. And one of the results of this, of course, is that policies can easily change. When you've got membership changing, you can have changes in ideas and things like that. They can happen much more easily, I should say. The third thing I was going to say is that the number and variety of these groups and publications is much less. I mean, the five that I've mentioned probably consist of 95% of the left of the day. There weren't any others. We're talking about a very restricted number of groups. Each had to be, therefore, fairly inclusive. There would be, for example, that within those groups, you would usually have quite a lot of different opinions about different subjects. So, again, that's quite different from today, whereas the SWP, for example, Socialist Workers' Party, they tend to be quite specific on different matters. And, you know, so we're talking about these groups having a certain wider ability to cope with different views, because they had to. Well, of course, that left them vulnerable to splits and disagreements within the party, because, you know, you had quite a lot, you had a limited number. One other point I wanted to make is that joint membership was common. I don't know if you, I think most of you are members, but one of the first questions you're asked when you join this party is, are you a member of any other group? And of course, for most people these days, you're not a member of more than one group. But in those days, it was very common. You would be a member jointly of, at the same time, you would be a member of the BSP and the ILP. Sorry, there's my alphabet soups again. But it was very common to be a member of two parties. So that meant that these sort of, the ideas within a party could be, or a group, or whatever you like to call them, a publication, could be shared much more easily. They were able to flow a lot more easily. And the final point is that, and this is not so much about the left in the First World War as about my response to it, and that is that although they were small in number, they were very active. Very, very active. I mean, it was not unusual for the membership to be, say, 80% active. And when I talk about active, I mean speaking, writing, that sort of thing. It was very common, especially outdoor speaking. That was how you made members. That's how you spread your ideas. Not really through the journals themselves, the journals and, you know, the papers of the day, which, of course, is difficult for me and for anyone else who looks into the subject to actually say what was really going on, because talks don't leave a physical record. When you give a talk, except these ones here nowadays, in those days you didn't have that sort of the talks were generally not recorded, they were not written down, so what that means is if you were actually to be there at the time, I might, for example, have very different conclusions to the ones I am making. Right, the first group I'd like to look at is the Clarion. Right, this was the best-selling left paper of the day, about 70,000 per week. And to put that into context, that means that it's actually one of perhaps five in all of Britain left papers, highest-selling left paper of all time. So it's pretty influential. It's a good seller, basically. It had a lot of influence, and it was the brainchild of this chappy here. We'll be seeing a lot of very nice facial hair. And this guy has a very nice moustache. Yes, it is. And I would love a moustache like that. Unfortunately, my moustaches grow outwards. So whenever I grow anything longer than sort of about yay big, it becomes a powder puff and I look very silly. So my equivalent of that would be just like that. Anyway, this is Robert Blatchford. He was the man who basically set up the Clarion. He was not the editor at the time of the First World War, but he had a controlling interest, and his friend called A.M. Thompson was the editor. But so basically he was the Clarion man. Okay? And one thing about the Clarion was, and in fact the most important thing about it, was its social activities, social and recreational activities. This is the Clarion van. And this was part of the whole ideology, the whole socialism of, so-called socialism, of the Clarion. Basically, it was fellowship. It was all about fellowship. It was about hanging out with your mates. And this is one place you would hang out with your mates. You would go on a caravan trip. This is the Clarion here, and it's pamphlets and things like that, and you would go out and you would sell those, and it would all be with your friends, and that was what socialism was. It was fellowship, good fellowship. It was an interesting publication, at least when it first started off. It was like a university rag mag. It was full of jokes, it was full of little stories. It was fun. It was a fun thing to do. It was a fun thing to do. It was a fun thing to read. As we shall see, there was a downside to that. It was very popular, incidentally, more up north than in London. It was very popular, for example, in Lancashire and Yorkshire. This guy here, actually, is McLean, John McLean. He was a very famous left communist. And I'm not sure exactly what he's doing here, because he certainly wasn't, he was quite an awake, politically aware fellow who should not have been associated with the Clarion in any way. As to the contents of it, Britain for the British. That's exactly what you would think of it. This is Blatchford's Bible. This is what he stood for. If you read it, to be fair to it, there's not a lot of racism in it. But the title has a certain suggestions, and there is quite a bit of that in it, to be honest. It's not racism, but it's nationalism. And this is something that was always tainted, the Clarion. It was always quite nationalist. It was horrible, I would say. It supported the Boer War, for example, because they were the Brits and they were fighting against those bad old Boers. It called, for example, Jewish immigrants unclean and unsavoury, which is not nice. And this is a particularly nasty pamphlet which I found upstairs and read. It's one of ours. This is so anti-working class that I was tempted to sling it in the bin just because it was so horrible. The trade unions are regarded in this, the trade union movement, is called a ghastly failure. And the strike weapon is called an abortion. So you can see what sort of publication this was. Basically, you were selling some pretty dire views through the means of fun. Okay, would anyone like to make a prediction as to whether the Clarion supported the First World War? Steve, did it support the First World War?
Yeah, probably.
Yes, you are damn right. There we are. This is the front page of the Clarion from immediately after the First World War was declared. Basically, as soon as it came on, as soon as the war started, Robert Blatchford said, well, this is a damn good war and you better fight in it. And he issued this lovely thing here that says, your king and country need you, a call to arms, God save the king. To call this organisation, or this publication, I should say, socialist, is like, even by left-wing standards, this one's not good. Anyway, but how did they support the war? And they supported it really, really strongly. For example, in a little bit after this, they opined, there's a nice word, they were rabid, basically. They opined that Germans should all be killed. The Empire demands that after the war, the German race be outlawed. That's a good one. And they also they printed fake letters to discredit the conscience. So they would allegedly conscience would write in saying, oh, I'm really stupid because I am a conscience. Please tell me what is wrong with me. So that they were basically discrediting conscientious objectors by printing fake letters, which is outrageous. And they also said that pacifists have no right to exist at all. That's a nice one. So the pacifists are going the same way as the Germans. Oh my word. And not only did they support it in words, they actually raised a company, the Fellowship Company of the, it was in the Cheshire Regiment, and it was actually a PALS battalion. And of course, we all know what happened to the PALS battalions. They went straight over the top. They weren't adequately prepared. They went straight over the top in the Battle of the Somme, got wiped out. So essentially, he's feeding the guns, this guy. I mean, really strongly feeding them. Okay, one thing that happened to them, to Blatchford particularly, with his friends, he got together with his friends, a fellow called Victor Fisher, and they formed the Socialist National Defence Committee. And this was basically a right-wing split from the Labour Party. They brought people out of the Labour Party, MPs, and of course they didn't bring members out, they brought out anyone they could get, basically. And their sole reason for existence was hounding pacifists and promoting the war effort. Excellent chappies. Later became something called the British Workers' League. And this was actually very popular in that part of the war. It had 77 branches and 10 MPs. So it was doing quite well. High-profile member of the British Workers' League was H.G. Wells, a well-known chappie. Later it became the National Democratic and Labour Party, and later it became part of the Liberal Party. So basically he's working against the Labour Party there, splitting the Labour, not that we care anyway, but from the left point of view, definitely a bad guy. Anyway, Blatchford, what did he do next? He lost a son in the war. Unlike Roger Kipling, who was also a jingoist before the war, jingoist being a nationalist, unlike Roger Kipling, who also lost a son, Roger Kipling, to his defence, did recant. He said, well, I'm not really sure that I was doing the right thing there. I just lost my son, which is like, you're learning from your mistakes. That's good on you. Blatchford did not learn. He later became a Tory. So he was going from the Labour point of view, Labour left, to being a Tory. Very easy for him. A former supporter called him the world's greatest traitor. Anyway, he lost all of his support. His publication went doom like that. I'm not really sure, because at the time, you know, people supported the war. But I think because it was such fun, you're going from a fun organisation to one which is killing people. There's too much of a clash. So basically, he lost everything. He lost all support, and the Clarion ceased in 1932. One of the organisations that set up the social organisations, National Clarion Cycling Club, still exists.
Yes.
And they actually, they are very retro, because they actually still use this. And they still use socialism, the hope of the world. Fellowship is life, lack of fellowship is death. But in this case, fellowship was death, the fellowship company. So, I've got a nice quote here from the Clarion's historian, Dennis Poy. He says, the Clarion's socialism was not in the least solemn, difficult, highbrow, dreary, theoretical, dogmatic, but a way of life to be enjoyed here and now, which men and women, young and old, would live in fellowship with each other in their everyday work and leisure activities. Well, I've got to say... What's that?
Alan Bennett's Clarion Cycling Club. Very good film.
Oh, right.
Box set.
Right. Anyway, to me, good fellowship was no excuse, was no substitute for good learning. And their vague sort of socialism led them down a blind alley. And there's a little summary of the Clarion. It was the most popular socialist paper, first published 1891, activity groups, record of militarism and nationalism, pro-war, lost all support, and died. My next one, the British Socialist Party. As it's always written in history books, it always says the British Socialist Party, not to be confused with the Socialist Party of Great Britain. That is us. That is us. Those are not us. Alphabet soup, tooting again. Tooting popular front of tooting. Right, the British Socialist Party was the youngest left-wing group. It was only formed in 1912. And the idea was, it was actually formed on the initiative of Blatchford. So there's a little hint to what might have happened. And the idea was to unite all the leftists in Britain. They wanted everyone to come in together and, you know, form one big party. We've seen quite a bit of that fairly recently, I think. That is the, you know, the idea that you can get everyone together, which you can't. Anyway, in the event, only the SDF joined. That's the Social Democratic Federation. And the Social Democratic Federation, which is like really what we've got to base our record on, this was formed in 1881, and it was the first left group in Britain, the first modern left group, first modern so-called socialist group. And it's the one that we broke away from in 1904. Our reasons that we actually said were it was anti-democratic, basically. And it was also reformist. It was also a lot of other things, and it certainly wasn't Marxist. Right, but to be fair to the SDF, it had a fairly good record of anti-imperialism. It was actually formed, or one of the reasons why the SDF was formed was to oppose coercion in Ireland. And coercion, I was told to explain this by someone, coercion was the attempt of the British government, the Liberal government at the time, to suppress the anti-landlord movement, which was doing rent strikes, very successfully, incidentally, by forces of repression, and that included suppression of the right to trial by jury. That was coercion in Ireland. So they had a fairly good record on that. And this was This is during the Boer War. The SDF opposed the British war effort and said, you know, we want peace, sort of thing. This is the great anti-jingo demonstration. A jingo, incidentally, I should, as I said before, it's a nationalist, basically, a militarist nationalist, a word nobody uses these days, nobody knows. This particular demonstration is quite interesting. This leaflet is quite interesting. It's a flyer. This was from our archives. And I'm pretty sure that a founder member of the party must have been on this demonstration, which is a nice little bit of history that keys into us. However, there was also this chappie, Henry Myers Hyman. He was a bad guy. You can see his top hat. He was very famous in pre-war London, pre-war socialist, I should say. That's a terrible word, isn't it? In the world of the left. He was basically one of the first people to popularise Marx. Marx did not like him because he popularised the works of Marx and printed his own sort of summary of them, but he never acknowledged him. And when he met Engels, Engels did not like him at all. Actually, I'm not sure if he met Engels, but they certainly didn't get on. He was quite an unpleasant person, I think, personally. But that's a personal judgment. But what he did do, he issued statements in favour of military rearmament and the like. He, for example, in 1911, in Justice, the SDF journal, which was owned by him, he said, "I consider the German Empire a direct danger to the peace of the world." And remember, this is a so-called socialist speaking, and he talked of the absolute necessity for an overwhelmingly strong navy. So he was a fair militarist guy. He was, to be fair, repudiated, and he was dropped from a lot of his official roles, because most people in there were social democrats, pretty much on the European sort of level. But he did, like I say, he owned Justice, or controlled Justice, so he had a lot of power still in the organisation. The SDF also had a history of wavering and reversing decisions. It wasn't really sure of its own mind. Example, attitude to the Labour Party. When the Labour Party was first set up, the SDF was an associated group. It actually came out the following year, on pretty much through the people of our founders, I suppose you would call them, who were objecting to it. We didn't want to associate with non-socialists, basically, in the Labour Party, because the Labour Party was definitely not socialist when it was formed. It was a trade union-based organisation, whatever that might mean, but essentially we did not like that, and we made them come out. But there was a big strand of opinion in the SDF that said we should be in Labour, and the BSP in 1914 was engaged in rejoining the Labour Party. So it was on and off and on and off, and it could have gone on for a long time. Now, would you like to tell me, what do you think the BSP did in the war? Did it come out in favour of the war in 1914 or not?
Yes, I think it did.
No, might be wrong. It wavered.
That's unusual.
It wavered. First of all, it issued this manifesto, this is the front page of Justice, from August the 13th, 1914. Basically, as soon as the war was declared, it issued a fair-to-averaging manifesto. It was opposing the war, but it did not oppose the war on class grounds. It opposed the war on the basis that it was a result of secret diplomacy. In other words, this is an undemocratic war. Also opposed it because we were fighting on the side of the Russians, and there was a big thing against Russian despotism. How could we fight for these Russians? And one thing that's very interesting about this thing, and you might be able to see it, here, the manifesto comes up to here, it's like blah blah blah, terrible stuff. But then it breaks into things about, yes, well, what we're interested in is the immediate passing of measures to secure the state and municipal ownership of these purchase, storage and distribution of the necessities of life. And this, that and the other reform. There's some education reforms, there's some health reforms. Basically, it's using the war as an excuse to put through a reformist programme, which is outrageous, because the war to end all wars has just broke out. Millions of people are going to die. I think a lot of people knew that, actually. And here you are, making it an excuse for reforms. terrible thing to do. So, yes, they did come out against the war, but a few months later, we had this little lovely... So, actually, they were kind of for the war. They were wavering again. This is when, this is a recruiting for the European War statement of the British Socialist Party, signed by their executive committee. Basically, they were joining the recruiting drive. So they'd gone from opposing the war to, actually, well, we're kind of for it, because we're in favour of recruiting. One thing that they said in favour of this, this is an excuse, is that the war was going to, they could use the recruiting drive to get some power to put forward their reforms, and one of the reforms was, of course, spreading socialism in the form of the nationalisation. That's what most of these lefties actually meant by socialism, nationalisation. And they actually did get their nationalisation. They get their nationalisation of the railways in 1914. So, you know, they achieved their measures. Whether it was them, we can say, no, it wasn't you. But, so basically they've wobbled. What I think they were really after is they were a very small organisation, and what they were after is they were after power. Any way that they could get it, any little ways they could sneak in. However, this position was not very popular. They actually had a big split over it. The SDF was about equally divided between the pro and the anti-war factions. Hindman, basically he's the figurehead. He's pro-war, I should say. He's obviously pro-war. The central branch of the BSP was also pro-war, and so was Justice. So they've got quite a big, you know, basis there. Most branches were anti-war. They did not like it. And eventually, of course, it came to the clash. Hindman was kicked out. He was actually jeered. He went into their annual conference and people jeered him, and they wouldn't let him speak because they were so, so disgraced by him. And he was a disgrace too. And so he got kicked out, which pleases me quite a lot, even though it's not our party that's kicking him out. He went on to form the National Socialist Party. I tried to find some pictures of the National Socialist Party of Great Britain, but possibly it's something that historians kind of push to one side because of its name. It was to be fair, it wasn't a racist organisation, but it was a nationalist organisation. The rump of the BSP, there was maybe 4,000 of them, so that's a third of what they had been before the war. They continued as the BSP, and they had a new journal called The Call. That's a rather nice thing, and here's an angel. But they're actually quite on the slide at that point because they've been discredited. Hindman is their main man. He's been discredited. You know, who else have you got? This became the paper set up, and eventually the BSP, the British Socialist Party, became the core of the Communist Party in 1920. And I think it was because they were an easy target. They were lost. They'd lost their man. They were in the wilderness, and they were looking for, you know, they were an easy prey, basically. Right, so that's my summary of the British Socialist Party, formed in 1911. Well, 1911, 1912, it's a moot point as to when it was formed. There's different historical versions of it. It was the successor of the SDF, the Social Democratic Federation. There's a hyphen in there for anyone who wants to write it down. Their paper was Justice. They had a record of reformism, a mixed record of nationalism, split by the war, and the largest section was the basis of the Communist Party. My next party, the Independent Labour Party. Now, this was the biggest pre-war left organisation. It was about 30,000 strong. Not too big, but big enough. Its paper was the Labour Leader. That sold maybe 50,000. Again, not, you know, it was fairly strong. Their socialism. Socialism was fairly similar to the Clarion. It was a vague sort of thing. And it also had, you know, a certain BSP-ish quality in that they were for nationalisation. They never really spelt it out. It was very vague. It was all full of wiffle-waffle. Soapy Sams, I would call them. And that is a rather nice picture, which is they had actually recently, 1914, they'd recently celebrated their 21st anniversary. and they had a coming of age party where people dressed up, which is very nice. And they had tight trousers and things like that. And they had horses, I believe, as well. It was a jolly time was had by all. And they had the flags of the world parading along. Not particularly, not what I would really choose to have, the flags of the world. I would have a big red flag, the flag of socialism, or whatever you would like to call it. But certainly the flags of the accumulated nations of the world is a bit dodgy. So the Independent Labour Party had a fairly good record, to be honest, of anti-war activity. You know, they were opposed to nationalism in a sort of vague sort of way. They were nice, we shall say. And during the Boer War, they opposed the Boer War. They engaged in an anti-militarist campaign. They had a big meeting, 1910, in Albert Hall, where they invited people like Bernstein along, and or Bernstein, even. So, you know, they did their little bit in their own way. And they had Jean Jaurès as well, if I pronounced that rightly. They had him there. So they had all the big European socialists of the day, socialists, in the hall speaking, and they had a big audience. And this is their leader, James Clear Hardy, and he is addressing a crowd. And this is immediately before the outbreak of the First World War, during the July days. And basically, you know, he's doing his stuff. He's saying, oh, war is a terrible thing. We must not have one. Now, who should I pick on now? Adam, did the ILP come out in favour of the war or against it?
Against it.
Yay! They were indeed against it. It's an obvious answer, isn't it? And this is their manifesto that they all, again, it's August the 13th, 1914. It's the ILP and the war. We do not like this war. It is a nasty war. But what's interesting, again, like the BSP, this is what I was going on about, the shared ideologies that could flow between them. They came out, because, but it wasn't, again, a class line. You wouldn't expect it. But it was also not an ethical pacifist line, not in the way that we understand it. It was, again, saying about secret diplomacy, this terrible secret diplomacy, it's kept from us. These, you know, we can't fight this war, it's terrible. Because it's been, you know, it's been done behind the scenes. And again, they made a big point about autocratic Russia. It's down here somewhere. Anyway, I should print these out. They kept to this line. They didn't waver, they kept to it. That's, you know, fair dues to them. They didn't waver, they didn't hesitate. They, at least on a national level. Individuals, branches, some of them defected. About a fifth of the membership was said to have joined the forces. But as a party, through the Labour leader, they did keep to their bits. But what happened is quite interesting, actually, because they engaged in an awful lot of this secret diplomacy business. Presumably, secret diplomacy, if it's open diplomacy, that's okay, and they would have fought the war. For example, if they'd published all these treaties, they'd have gone, well, this is a lovely war, we'll be in for it. And this, you can guess what the poison that destroys is. And this is by a fellow called E.D. Morrell, who's one of the people who I'm going to talk about now. It's the causes of the war. The causes of the war were secret diplomacy. They were obsessed by it. And like I say, it's an interesting, you know, it's like, well, would you be against the war if the diplomacy wasn't secret? Well, I don't know. Perhaps what they were looking for is an excuse, a logical excuse, to oppose the war. I don't know. But what's interesting is the contrast from 1939, where really there wasn't they hadn't got the excuse of secret diplomacy, they hadn't got the excuse of Russia, but they were against the war again, but on a pacifist, an ethical pacifist line, which is an interesting contrast. One of the consequences of this business was that they attracted and associated with a lot of very dubious characters who were also into secret diplomacy. This is a pamphlet by a leaflet, I should say, by a fellow called Sir Norman Angell, who later joined the ILP, and he's on the anti-Russia kick here. If England goes to war, it will be on the side of Russia, which is Russia. Russia is the is our enemy. It has designs on our Indian Empire. This has been shooting down workmen in the streets, as if the British government did not do that. It's of all the countries, it is the greatest enemy. So, you know, you can see there that this is attracting people who are, to be honest, our Indian Empire is not socialist even on leftist grounds. This is not to be encouraged. But this guy, as I've said, came into it. And one of the associations was through the Union of Democratic Control. This was something that was associated with the ILP at the time. It was a secret diplomacy organisation going on about Russia and what have you. And another organisation that a lot of ILPers were in was the Anti-Conscription Fellowship, the Non-Conscription Fellowship. And this sort of crusade against conscription, well, you know, it's all very well, but actually you had a lot of different people involved in it, and a lot of people were anti-conscription. And although it says it in very small letters down here, these people here are coming to associate with the ILPers up here. And we've got Clifford Allen and Fenner Brockway. And both of these were very high up people in the ILP. And on the same page, coming to associate with them. And these people are backed, incidentally, by Henry Ford himself, the arch capitalist of the whole world. These people, so Henry Ford was basically anti-conscription, anti-war. They're associating with a senator and a judge. Is this really proper, you know, proper socialist or even leftist behaviour? And I think the answer is no. And one of the what happened to the ILP is quite interesting as well. After the war, 1918, the Labour Party conference, before the war, as I've said before, it was the political content of the Labour Party. The Labour Party, the Parliamentary Labour Party, did not like this one bit. The ILP is going against it. The Labour Party was for the war. It was, you know, it had power through the war. It was very, very upset by this. And it set up its own constituency, Labour parties. This was, in fact, if you look in a lot of the histories, most of them are concerned with Clause 4, which, to be honest, it's a piece of paper. The constituency Labour parties were far more important in the 1918 constitution of the Labour Party. What they were designed to do was to get rid of the ILP. They didn't, not initially. 1926 was when the ILP peaked. So actually it had emerged from the war and it had been boosted by it. And apparently it was in very good shape. However, the Labour Party really didn't need it. And eventually what happened was the ILP left it. I think this was a consequence of the war. And it's, you know, it had crossed the Labour Party essentially. And what it did was after the 1929-31 Labour government under Ramsay MacDonald, who was at one point the chairman of the ILP and the president of it, he broke with them. Basically, they defected. They went on their own and they thought they could become big, but they weren't. They were supplanted by the Communist Party as the big left organisation. Died a death. Rejoined Labour 1975 as a publishing group. And they have been ultra-loyalist since 1975. They have definitely pulled the forelock because they do not want to be on their own ever again. Right. I've been talking a damn long time. I'm sorry about that. I've not got much.
Not long enough.
No. Right. The ILP, this is just a summary of them, formed 1893, political section of the Labour Party. They opposed the war consistently on a national level, but they did opposed it on democratic grounds. Individuals, branches, whatever you wavered. They merged, apparently a better position, but they were replaced and died. Now, the Socialist Labour Party. This again, I'm sorry, this is very much, this is the SLP alphabet soup. Now, the ones I've talked about so far have been way, way off our political, our position. They've been a long way away from us. The Socialist Labour Party wasn't. 1903, going back 10 years, they were our comrades. They were our impossibilist comrades within the SDF. What happened was, essentially, we made a pact with these guys. We were in London, they were in Scotland. We made a pact not to leave or do anything without consulting the other guys. They did not adhere to it. They went ahead and broke with the SDF. We wanted to work within it as long as possible. However, we got slung out. Anyway, so, you know, basically it was a tactical difference. At least, to some extent, they were good Marxist guys. They had that's a little advert for them. They adopted the name and the slogan, which is this Armoured Hammer of the American SLP. Though, of course, the Scottish lot have a U in it, and the Americans don't. And there, incidentally, there's another common feature between us and the SLP. Their publication, their paper, The Socialist, was owned and controlled by the Socialist Labour Party. This is rather interesting because, generally speaking, the paper of a group is not owned directly. It's usually owned by a subsidiary. But so they're on our sort of wave level. They've got some Marxist content. However, they were very partial to causes. And one of their ones, before I should go on, so let me just point this out. This is a pamphlet issued by the Socialist Labour Party. And it has quite a nice quotation because it proves their Marxist content. Basically, they said that war is the struggle for the conquest of foreign markets is the cause of war, and they blamed the capitalists just like we did. They had the same approach to war. However, they had a little thing for causes, and this is their cause, if you like, the cause of Deleonism. This is Daniel de Leon. He's got a fairly normal beard. It's a nice beard. It's a fairly normal beard, I think. Basically, Deleonism was socialist industrial unionism. You had one big union, essentially one big strike, and that was how you were going to achieve the revolution. Though in the case of the SLP, they also said it would be through Parliament. There was a joint thing. It's very confusing as to whether they actually, how the revolution was occurred, but they did go in for it in a big way, which we never did. We were sort of, well, you know, it was a bad idea because as soon as you started to set up unions, as soon as you started to set up your own union in Britain, actually trying to split a union is, split a trade union and form your own separate socialist trade union. That's like very much an anathema to trade unionists because you don't split the union. And it was disastrous anyway in this country because the unions had already unionised. They'd already got as members as many people as they could. And they were spreading. They did not need that. It was antagonistic towards the unions. The pamphlets, the other cause they actually did was the pamphlets, because they issued hundreds of these, thousands. I mean, they went into the pamphlets in a big way. Deleonist, but also Marxist pamphlets. Until recently, you could actually still buy these. These were like mint condition, pre-war pamphlets. Some of them had been recovered in the 1920s or 30s. You could get the mint condition from a guy called Jim Plant. He was the SLP's last known literature secretary. They might have had one after him, but I've never come across him. Anyway, they were partial to causes. And one of the other things that they also did was they equivocated, they wavered. They had a tendency to waver, and one of the things that they did wavering was sometimes they had an immediate programme. In other words, sometimes they supported reforms and sometimes they didn't. Eventually they decided not to, but they weren't really sure. Again, they were like the VSP. They didn't really know their own mind. They were hesitating, I would say. Right, who should I pick on this time? Ollie! Did the SLP support the war?
No.
Yes, you were quite right. They did not support the war. They issued... I'm afraid I haven't got a copy of their anti-war manifesto because the British Library is transferring everything from Colindale, which is my favourite place, to the one in St Pancras, which is horrible and all full of smart young people.
Not true.
It's all full of smart young people.
Not true.
Don't like smart young people. So, and their anti-war manifesto was not dissimilar to ours. It was very much like, they said, for example, here's a quote, "The capitalist class of all nations are our real enemies. It's against them that we direct all our attacks." So they're laying the blame for the war at the system itself, just like we did. You know, however, they did equivocate. They were waverers again. And one thing they did do during the early part of the war, they printed correspondence in their papers. In fact, from some fairly high up members, such as Arthur McManus, who was later their first parliamentary candidate, their first and only parliamentary candidate, and the editor of their journal. And they basically, it was a theoretical argument whether you could support a war for national defence. But nonetheless, it was wavering, are we really for this war or not? To be fair to them, again, waverings overcome, and they went forward on an anti-war basis. However, this may have been a bit too much, this anti-war, because the anti-war cause, again, I said they were partial to causes, they adopted it as their own. And they indulged in all sorts of united front tactics with all sorts of other left groups for the war. So recruitment sort, they did quite well out of it. But a lot of the people were joining because it was an anti-war crusade party, an anti-war party, not because they believed in socialism. And there's a difference. And I think this is the main difference between us and the SLP during the war. They went full out for anti-war. And this is a rather, it was particularly noticeable, incidentally, in 1918, because the Socialist Party and the Socialist Standard was quite quiet during 1918. It didn't have the big headlines that you'll see on the exhibition. It didn't have those saying, you know, down with the war. Well, actually, it didn't say down with the war, but that sort of thing. It didn't have a lot of anti-war stuff because we were worried. We were worried about being shut down. We were worried about people being beaten up, that sort of thing. We were a bit quietist. We tried to press instead for socialism. And the contrast with the socialist and the SLP could not be stronger. This is something from theirs, March 1918. This one is these are cartoons, basically the front cover of the SLP paper, the socialist, not just anti-war cartoons, pretty bad ones, to be honest. You've got David Lloyd George down here, making fun of him. We've got a starving patriot, we don't think. We've got our British armaments on one side, German armaments on the other, they're the same. We've got bring home the boys now. I'm not sure as if that is really a socialist sentiment. And peace, bread and liberty. Sounds familiar? So basically what they're doing is they're going on a full-out anti-war crusade. We wouldn't really disagree with it, but there's no socialist content in this, really. We're not talking really socialism. And as you might expect, they get raided every day. And they issued this lovely thing here, which is their manifesto on the freedom of press. And there you can see the hammer and arm, or the arm and hammer again. And basically, they were adding the defence of the right to free speech to their list of causes. And they did love these causes. Now, one of the reasons, of course, why they could do this is because they were further away from Whitehall. We are right in the centre of the, you know, as London, a London-based group, we're right in the centre of, you know, the state. London is the home of the state. We're going to be cracked down on even harsher than, you know, even more than they were. And they were cracked down pretty badly. So we were kind of shying away from that. You could call it cowardice, but I would call it sense. Because, you know, we're there to carry out socialism. We're not there to carry out an anti-war crusade. Of course, the ultimate thing was, of course, that this obsession with causes, adopting these causes, they adopted the cause of the Russian Revolution, the October Revolution. And they became known as British Bolsheviks. There's actually a book with that title. And, of course, when the Russians transferred their franchise to the BSP because it was a nice little, you know, group they could... It was the biggest social democrat group that was on offer in this country. When they transferred their franchise to them, Socialist Labour Party was finished. It went just down like that. Everyone abandoned it. Their publication stopped within a year or so of 1920. They did not last long. They came back every now and again. They had some revivals, but essentially they were never the same again. And basically they became extinct in the 1970s. Nobody knows when. It's a mystery. Anyway, so that's the Socialist Labour Party. I should just give me a run through the bit. Formed in 1903. They adopted socialist industrial unionism. They were against the war on class grounds, but some members equivocated initially, fair dues. Identified with the anti-war cause very strongly, split by the Russian Revolution and faded away. The last group, you'll be glad to know, the last people, in fact, it's not a group, but it could be called a group, is Freedom, the publication Freedom, which I think most people will probably be aware of today. A lot of people read it. It's just gone online, so won't be able to read it in physical form anymore, I've been told. I like my paper. Anyway, one of the things about Freedom was the main publication of British anarchism at the time. It was the, it was the standard, I suppose, of British anarchism. British anarchism, very dependent on personalities. Much more so, I think, than conventional socialism.
Socialism.
The left, I would say. I should really say the left. The Freedom itself, first published 1886. So it was quite old. It was quite old. And I think that showed, actually. Basically, what Freedom was, it was a vehicle for this guy. This guy's views, Kropotkin. They featured him an awful lot. He has the best beard of all. The most, the fullest and the greatest beard of all. So basically, they were very heavily dependent on Kropotkin. It was an odd publication because if you've come, like I did, from reading the modern Freedom and going back in time and reading one that's 100 years old, that's quite a shock actually because Freedom itself in those days was very philosophical. It didn't really go in for the class war business that it does now. It was quite odd. But, to be fair, Kropotkin did. This is one of his publications, which was published by Freedom. It's a Freedom Press publication. And, like I say, it's a vehicle for him, essentially. They did a lot of Kropotkin work. This one is a nice class analysis of war. It's available at the back there, if you want to flick through it and put it in the pamphlet pot. I've not got my pamphlets this time round. There's a nice little quote that I would like to do for you, just to show you that he was a class analysis person. He says, "All wars in Europe during the last 150 years were wars fought for industrial advantage and the rights of exploitation." So he was not a head in the cloud sort of guy. He had a class analysis. And often we actually sold his pamphlets. This party sold his pamphlets and we didn't think anything of it because within limits, he was a fairly okay sort of guy. However, as we should see, oh yes, I'd just like to run through just to show that the original Freedom was a slightly eccentric, philosophical, esoteric sort of publication. This was the September 1914 edition, which I've got the front cover of here. The front cover was obviously about the war. It was, I'll just flick to it later. But the rest of it was Kropotkin, The Modern State, The Literature of Anarchism. These were pages. And the editorial, of all things, this is the outbreak of the First World War. Everyone's going to die, pretty much. Their editorial was about communist kitchens. Food. Eaten communally. Dudes! Their main article, so the editorial was about food, and their main article, the longest article, was on the 70th birthday of Edward Carpenter. Dearie me, saying, "Happy birthday, Edward. The First World War might have broken out and everyone's going to be killed, but I hope you have a lovely happy birthday and I've made you a cake." weird. And of course, they finished off with a primer of anarchism. Very theoretical, quite in the clouds, which is, again, I'd say, contrary to Peter Kropotkin. They did. Right, oh, my last person, who shall I might pick on last? Jacqueline, I've got to you. Did freedom come out in favour of the war or against the war?
I have no idea.
It was actually against the war. And here is their front cover. Blood and Iron. It's... Well, actually, don't say yet, because their analysis was rather interesting. They knew about the class position. They mentioned it quite a number of times. They actually... But they asked the question, who is responsible? This is the first line. Who's responsible? Capitalism? And its twin brother, the state? We wouldn't say that. We would say capitalism, full stop. You don't need to say the state as well. It's part of it. And then they answer their question. It's not capitalism and the twin brother, the state. It's you, yourselves. You, the people, are responsible. You are to blame. You did not want the revolution, so now you have the war. That's a nasty thing to say. Anyway, I think this shows a complete alienation from the working class. You're saying you, for a start. You're not saying we. You're saying you. You're taking yourself out of the class and you're saying you are to blame. You did not abide by what we told you to do. You are to blame. An interesting little bit of esoterica again. I think this shows that they're quite philosophical, quite head in the clouds. An interesting way of putting it. It's something that perhaps a speaker of ours might have mentioned on the platform. There's no way it's going to go in the journal because you don't abuse your audience in that way. You're putting yourself, you know, against the class, essentially. Right. Kropotkin, however, was a different kettle of fish. Oh, just incidentally, this is my final beard. I've got to do a beard again. This is Rudolf Rocker. He actually wrote the Blood and Iron editorial. He was their, I suppose, he was their main writer. He was their main writer that wasn't Kropotkin. He was the, he was one of their men, their main man, except for Kropotkin, who was, I suppose, their theorist. Right, they, after the outbreak of war in October, they were considering this for a long time because he'd actually written this pretty much on the outbreak of war. They printed Kropotkin's letter. And this is quite notorious, and it's very seldom that you will actually see it. And unfortunately, you can't read it here. But if you wanted a copy, I will send it to you. Basically, he's going against the whole of his life here, which is, on anarchism, he's going against the state, which is what he's done all of his life. He's opposed the state. He's opposed capitalism. He's an anarcho-communist. And all of a sudden, we find him supporting the war. This war is a war of German aggression. This is our main thing. What we must do, this is our main thing of the day. We must oppose German aggression in the rights of small nations. Why is this guy on? Okay, he's old. And I don't think that's any excuse. When I get to be old, I do not expect to go soft on capitalism. In fact, I expect to go harder and nastier as I get older. So that's quite an interesting reaction from him, and one that I don't think anyone was expecting. Certainly, the Freedom was not expecting it. They did not know what to do with this letter. They thought, God, we've got to print it eventually. And they did. And there it is. There is the letter. So what happened to Freedom? They did not know what to do. They separated themselves from Kropotkin, nothing to do with us, and of course they've lost their main reason for existence, which was as a vehicle for Kropotkin. They lost it until 1927, but they were always on the decline after that point. But to be fair, most anarchists did oppose the war, and some of them opposed it. Oh, there's some weird anarchism. Anarchism's always been weird. And this one, again, it's a pamphlet you can read at the back, is from the Bristol anarchist group. Anarchist groups at the time were almost never national. They were always very localised. This is called The Last War. George Barrett, he was a fairly influential anarchist of the day. This is the last war. A pamphlet he issued, and this is a worker with a rifle and a French hat, and he is about to take control of the factories here. And what George Barrett, incidentally, I had to bring this in, nothing to do with freedom, had to bring it in because he said you should join, workers should join the army so they'll get weapons training. And once they've got weapons training, you'll be in a better position to take control physically of these factories. However, you would also be dead on the Western Front. Anyway, so I'm just going to summarise. That was a byline which I had to bring in because I thought it was so funny. The idea that you'd join the army so you could take over the factories. Right, so Freedom, main British anarchist publication. First, 1886. They were Kropotkinites. They had a good record of class opposition to war. Fair dues. Kropotkin supported the war. Freedom did not. But they were robbed of their reason for existence. Now, I will just say where we differ. This is my bit that I was told to do, how we are better than anyone else. We opposed the war consistently. This is the First World War. We opposed it consistently. All the way through, we took the same line. We never deviated from this. We opposed the war on class grounds. We didn't have this business of, oh, it's secret diplomacy. We didn't win, basically. We did not need an internal discussion. We did not need it. And the reason why we didn't need it is because we were educated on class position. Our members are educated on the working class position, and once you know that, it becomes easy to say what is the position on this, that or the other. As long as you understand your class position in society, you will know it. You do not need to discuss it whether there's a national defence war. That's stupid. We did not get distracted by causes. Again, how we differ from the SLP. And what we did throughout was we put forward the case for socialism. That's me lot.